Hi, everybody. Welcome to the free preview of this month's What a Cartoon Movie. Just Henry here, because we are so far ahead on making our podcast, we actually kind of forgot to record this one together, our free preview for it. But that's how exciting things are on the Patreon right now and on the free feed. That includes our What a Cartoon Movies, where we are doing some awesome stuff this month. The What a Cartoon Movie is the Lupin the Third film, The Castle of Cagliostro, the first movie directed by Hayao Miyazaki, and we go deep, almost 4 hours long about this film, and also about the career of Yasuo Otsuka, mentor of Miyazaki that many in America have not heard about. We talk all about that, and then go scene by scene in the classic Lupin the Third adventure film. And we're going to play a lengthy clip for you here, but if you'd like to hear the entire 4 hour long podcast for yourself, you need to sign up at the $10 level at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. Right now, you'll get all of our previous What a Cartoon Movies when you sign up for that as well. That means movies like the previous Miyazaki film we covered, Kiki's Delivery Service, Batman Mask of the Phantasm, Akira, A Goofy Movie, Tiny Toons How I Spent My Vacation, Beavis and Butthead Do America, The Cowboy Bebop Movie, Iron Giant, The Animatrix, SpongeBob SquarePants Movie, and tons more. Over 60 hours of exclusive podcasts are yours at the $10 level. And if you're not already a patron, you also get all the stuff at the $5 level. Podcasts a week ahead of time and ad-free. Over 20 interviews with folks who have worked on The Simpsons as far back as the first shorts. And right now, our newest exclusive mini-series. In the past, we've done episodes of Futurama, King of the Hill, and the entire series of The Critic. Adding to that Patreon-exclusive mini-series is our Mission Hill breakdown of every single episode of that show, created by Bill Oakley and Josh Weinstein, our two favorite writers on The Simpsons. It is a ton of fun. You'll get to hear that as well for $10 a month or $5 at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. So please sign up today. Check it out if you want to hear the full thing. Now, to further entice you, check out this lengthy clip about the creation of Castle of Cagliostro. Now, let's talk about the real star of this history piece. Not Hayao Miyazaki, because we did talk a whole lot about him in our Kiki's Delivery Service thing, though we will touch on him some. No, I want to talk about living legend of the Japanese animation scene, and honestly, global animation scene, Yasuo Otsuka.
Now, this name is new to me, but you've been telling me a lot about him over the past few days, and I'm just kind of blown away by how, like, he should be more well-known in America.
I've become Homer with Thomas Edison in this last 2 weeks, but I feel foolish for not knowing more about him. Like, there is an interview with Otsuka that was in the 2004 DVD release of Castle of Cagliostro, or mid-2000s DVD release, and that's when I first heard of him, but I still never really dug into him. I was like, yeah, he's like an animator, whatever. No, he's actually an incredibly important mentor, designer, and like scholar of animation who built the animation, that gave so much to the Japanese anime industry that, as an outsider, especially when so many of his major works are not officially localized in America, you don't know these things. Like I did not, but now I do. And I, again, speaking of things that aren't localized, you gotta find out there, folks. I don't know how, but the documentary about Yasuo Otsuka called Joy in Motion, it's a Japanese TV documentary about his career, 2 hours long. It's amazing. I learned a ton of stuff from it. I'm just going to tell you in this, but seek it out. You will learn so much about him. But so Otsuka, born 1931, still with us at age 88. And he was just 13 when the war ended.
Wow.
And he has a sprawling career in both cartooning and law enforcement. Before he got into cartooning, he wanted to move to Tokyo, and he said, back then, you needed special permission to move during the occupation. And so if you joined law enforcement, that was one of the ways you could get it. And so he was like an assistant in the narcotics. And he remembered seeing like this American agent who was there show him off, like, look at this awesome gun. Bang, bang, bang. He's like, whoa, guns are cool. Like, he loves guns. He thinks guns are really cool. He loves trains and he loves drawing cars. Like, vehicles and gunplay are Otsuka's specialties, as making him a perfect fit for Lupin later in his career. And he also, though, came up at a time where there wasn't even a school for it, or if there was a school for animation in Japan, he wasn't able to attend it. So he just learned on the fly. Like, he was just a constant doodler, loving to draw things. And then in 1956, he applies to Toei Doga, which would later be called Toei Animation, which, other than Tezuka's company Ibmushi Pro, I think it was the only major animation production company in the 50s in Japan.
That sounds right, yeah.
And so he joins up, he passes the animation test, and they're like, all right, we're gonna put you to work and teach you. And he was just like thrown in the deep end with the film known in America as The Tale of the White Serpent, which is famously the first color animated feature in Asia history. Mm. Like, the first. Already showed his skill at animating, and that with some amazing, like, giant monster fights in it. He does such a good job in just that one. And in trying to learn animation early on, he, again, no school, but he could check out from the library animation books. They had a fully in English, and he's knowledgeable of English. He can speak it. So he gets this book called Animation by Preston Blair.
Oh, yeah, very famous book.
And he redraws every page of it, text too, just to learn how to do it.
He's like a monk.
In the documentary, he's like, yeah, here's all my pages that are just, I redid the entire page. And it's just amazing. And he's like, yeah, when you draw it yourself, you learn. Like, it's how I learn. And it's crazy to see him just copying. You're like, here's a Mickey Mouse motion line. Like, it's pretty simple. And that was his closest thing to, like, formal training. So he's working at Toei, which is mainly in films in the 50s. 1959, he is working on Shonen Sarutobi Sasuke, where he will meet a newly hired assistant director named Isao Takahata. Mm. This is a new employee who doesn't draw, but he's more of a manager and also good at storytelling. And Otsuka instantly sees talent in him, and he becomes a mentor for Takahata, who's only a few years his junior. Otsuka, though, he says he's not really a director. Like, he actually has few official directing credits because he must prefers, like, sticking to the animation and not going above that level. He talks about how, like, he's like, let directors direct and I'll stick to my thing. Hmm. Though he still ends up as, like, animation director on things, which really, yeah, I think in those situations, it's like the Isao Takahata position of the director who doesn't draw stuff, who just says to them, the animation director, hey, draw that, or I think you should draw this.
Can you draw faster?
Yes, sir. I mean, Otsuka, the backbreaking labor of these animation things, too. Like, it's, I am just impressed. Otsuka is still with us for how much work he had to do.
For sure, yeah.
And so while working on a number of features, Otsuka was quickly becoming Toei's top animator. And in 1963, he's working on Toei's first television series, Wolf Boy Ken. And that's where he meets a young in-betweener named Hayao Miyazaki. And he takes Hayao under his wing. Hayao, we talked about before, you know, born in 41, had no real formal training either, but just a constant artist, like just drawing all the time, never stopping. And Toei Animation, his first job in the industry in 63. And Otsuka and Takahata, they both kind of take him under their wings. They impress him into their union. Like, that's where Miyazaki becomes a Marxist for a time. Mm. Because he's just so into the Toei Union. And the Toei Animators Union, it's a very political time in the early 60s in Japan. They're kind of battling against the company at Toei. So by the mid-60s, Otsuka and Takahata are working on films and TV shows together a ton of times. And that's when Otsuka pushes Takahata to take on his first directing job, which will be on a film of many names, but it's Little Norse Prince or Horus or Prince of the Sun. Like, it has a million different names, but it was the one scene where they were like, we don't want to make a kid's cartoon anymore. Like, Otsuka, Takahata, and Miyazaki were like, we don't want to make kid stuff anymore. We want to make a film for more grown-up people. Like, this is an adult industry, too. And so, and it's also very much about worker solidarity and the power of workers. So it's a very political statement they want to make there, too. And Otsuka is right there helping every bit as animation director. And he also opens up the door, like, Miyazaki, at his junior level, he wasn't supposed to give any story, like story input, storyboarding. That wasn't Miyazaki's place. But on Horus, he gets moved up to that level and gets to have way more creative input, even getting to be a key animator on stuff. So it's a major film and is looked back on as a very groundbreaking film that Otsuka was involved in. But it was not a hit, and Toei and management saw it as a giant failure and basically demoted Takahata and kind of punished everybody else there.
That's on Blu-ray now. Yeah, you have the Blu-ray.
I do. I still haven't watched it. I will say it feels almost like homework to watch it, but I do need to.
I'm sure you'll get something out of it, though.
Oh, for sure. For sure. But I've seen clips in there. It's incredibly impressive clips. They're just showing off the entire time everything they've learned over the past like decade as animators. So Takahata is demoted. Otsuka is also looking for an exit, as is Miyazaki. But they do work on Toei's iconic adaptation of Puss in Boots, which, that was such a huge hit. It became the mascot of Toei.
Still, I've never seen a frame of that, but I know it's so important to Toei.
It's very important. I've watched an unsubtitled version of it, but it's a kid's movie, so I kind of get it.
I know the NES game came to America.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it did.
But the Puss in Boots film, Miyazaki and Otsuka worked a shitload on it, as did some other people that would follow them to Lupin. And if you watch the last 30 minutes of it, which is just like one long action sequence, it is a giant fight in a castle, and it is so Cagliostro. Like, I think a lot of the setting of Cagliostro is chosen as a reference to the work they did on the Puss in Boots film. Check that out if you want to see really cool stuff. And it also shows Otsuka is so good at drawing like silly villains. That's one of his best thing. He does it great with the Lucifer villain in Puss in Boots, and he will follow that over to his work on Zenigata. Like, Zenigata works so great as this buffoon because Otsuka is so good at drawing that. So after Puss in Boots, Miyazaki and Otsuka, they're working on adaptations of Alibaba and Animal Treasure Island. But in 1971, Miyazaki and Takahata decide to leave, and they're going to leave for Nippon Animation. Meanwhile, Otsuka sticks around Toei, even taking on some of their animated features and just a bunch of stuff that didn't work out. But eventually, though, he will leave in 1969 because TMS is founded.
Our heroes, finally.
Our beloved TMS.
Yes,
yeah.
They made everything we love.
1969, Tokyo Movie, as it was called then, they are a subsidy of a bigger company, but they're looking to get into animation production too. The founder of TMS is shown the manga of Lupin, which is like just 2 years old at this time. And he's told like, this would be great. This could be our show. This would work. We can do this. And they decide, all right, we're going to do it. But they're so small, they can only like afford a pilot. They want to do a pitch pilot, which ends up being about a 10-minute long CinemaScope movie. So it's like a widescreen pitch, and it looks really great. So under the supervision of animator Masaki Osumi, the pilot film for Lupin is made, and the important hire to it is Otsuka. He really wanted to do it. He was also working on there's a first season of Moomins that he did that everybody loved except for the creator of Moomins.
Yeah, that anime, that Moomin anime, or Moomime as I call it. apparently that's all on YouTube. I found it the other day. The Moomin state just put it all up online on YouTube, so you can watch it. Yeah, it's all dubbed.
Shit.
Yeah,
I gotta watch this.
Yep. It's so pretty.
Now, not unlike the Lupin books and Lupin the Third comics, America didn't get many Moomins. So you go to Europe or Japan, they love their Moomins. We barely know. We got Smurfs. I would trade Smurfs for Moomins
Smurfs
any
are
day
just
of the
like
week.
Shitty Moomins. Get them out of here.
So Otsuka, he's working on Moomins, which Miyazaki and Takahata were like, man, I wish we were working on Moomins. That looks awesome.
I want a piece of that Moomin. But that Moomin money is mine.
But then it's funny to think that he's working on Moomins, but he's like, no, I want to be on the sexy, violent Lupin project. I want to work on that. And so he talks about how he worked with Monkey Punch a bit in the beginning to try to figure out how to adapt him. But Monkey Punch quit pretty soon just because he's like, this, I can't do this. This is so hard to do with my comic book deadlines as well. And so Otsuka and his team, basically figured out for themselves and set all the rules of what Lupin movement will be like. So he is incredibly key to the adaptation of Lupin to film. And in the original pilot, only two voices that would stick in the classic voice cast are there. You've got Kiyoshi Kobayashi as Jigen, who still does Jigen to this day. I'm knocking on a table every time I say
even in the new stuff.
He is currently him.
Excellent. Like, okay.
At Monkey Punch's funeral, he had some whimsical statements of saying, like, I outlived you. I can't believe it's just me left on the Lupin stuff. And also, I believe she's still with us, but is retired from the role of Fujiko. But Eiko Masayama, she is also amazing. Like, I love her as Fujiko. Otsuka just fully embraces what he can do with Lupin. The pilot film, you know, it's rough in some places, again, made in 1969, but the spirit of Lupin is just there. You can see it. They've already got it figured out. And they want to pitch it as a movie, but nobody's buying. They can't sell it as a film. And over time, TMS reworks it to sell it as a TV show. And by 1971, they finally get somebody to buy it. And this was a major thing they touched on in the Joy of Motion documentary. I didn't realize about Lupin that. Lupin the Third is regarded as the first grown-up anime in Japan. Like
just the TV show?
Just the TV show, yeah. The 71 TV show.
I was thinking of that because in our history of animation, we are very America-centric, just as like a people, as Americans, where we're like, well, yeah, there are no adult TV shows between the Flintstones and the Simpsons. There just weren't any. Maybe wait till your father gets home, but who cares? But it's like, no, like, look at other countries. They were doing this stuff way before us.
Yeah, though, you know, from our American perspective, at least for me, I always thought Japan had adult cartoons because we got the, you know, hyper-violent, hyper-sexualized OVAs of the 80s.
Not
here.
For kids.
But the case was, like, when I talked about their biggest hits of Toei, Puss in Boots, they got this Moomins, they got Alibaba. These were kids' productions. So Lupin actually has kind of a Simpson-style effect on a generation of animators who see, oh, I can do like sexy gunplay in my shows. I don't have to adapt some classic work of literature, Disney style. Like it really expanded minds just seeing this show.
There was always plenty of adult manga, not like porn or like ultra violence, but like a manga that adults would read about like adult stories. So it makes sense that eventually you would see these in animated form.
Mm-hmm. And also, you know, similar to what happened in America, the generation who is normalized with animation as kids, they grow up and still want to enjoy animation, so animation grows up with them. Same with video games. Mm-hmm. Lupin the Third begins in 1971. It's ordered for 26 episodes. Very importantly, when the show starts, is they cast Lupin with a new actor, Yasuo Yamada. And that guy rules. Like, RIP, passed away in 95. He was already famous because he dubbed every Clint Eastwood movie in Japan.
Wow. He was Clint Eastwood.
He was Clint Eastwood, yeah.
Probably not doing that voice, I'm guessing.
No. But that's what is so... He's the gold standard for Lupin. Nobody does it better than him, I would say. And I think when they hire the Clint Eastwood guy, who's also so good at comedy, that's why, like, Lupin is a buffoon 80% of the time, but that's why when he gets serious, it also matters. Like, ooh, he put on a serious voice. Joke time's over for Lupin. And so Yamada, huge part of the appeal of Lupin, would voice him for close to 25 years. Osumi, who was the director of the pitch pilot, he would be the director of the series. 6 episodes in, he's given a ton of notes, and the ratings aren't good, and he rejects all those notes and, like, I'm not changing this. And he is fired. And so Osumi is gone, though on the credits, he'll always be the director because I maybe it's a respect thing. They're just like, no, we don't want it to reflect he was fired. But they need new directors. Meanwhile, Hayao Miyazaki and Isao Takahata are in the same production building trying to sell a Pippi Longstocking's adaptation, not working out. So Otsuka is like, I know two guys who can direct this show. So starting with episode 7, Miyazaki and Takahata are the directors of Lupin, and they work way harder on changing it. It's really the 9th episode is fully theirs. They kind of rework stuff in episodes 7 and 8, and it's just, I watched episode 7, and it's like, boy, this is just uneven. It feels, there's like missing scenes in it and stuff. But honestly, if that Pippi Longstocking show had been made, Miyazaki and Takahata would never work on Lupin, and who knows where Lupin would be.
It probably would have ended, yeah.
And so Miyazaki took it on, but in his book Starting Point, he has a 1980 reflection on his work on Lupin, and he says he wanted to change it in way more ways. Like, Lupin was written as this kind of just idle playboy who lived in a mansion and just stole stuff because he felt like it. Miyazaki defined that as apathy, and he's like, no, I don't like that. That's not who Lupin is to me. And same with he said he didn't like the, quote, cheap eroticism they were doing with Fujiko. He wanted to do more with her character. And he also just wanted them to be, you know, poorer and just be this like weird group of vagabonds who just jump from job to job and have no home or anything. And so that he also wanted Lupin to have more common things. Like, he was in the original pilot, he's driving a BMW that they even joke of, like, he drives it because it was Hitler's favorite model, which is a weird joke. But when Miyazaki was on there, no, he drives a Fiat. The Fiat in this movie is what Miyazaki wants
tiny
him
car.
To drive.
You can see Miyazaki, his Marxism is coming through. Like, we need a story about the common man. Not a story about some rich playboy.
He doesn't own fancy guns. He owns a Walther P-38, which is a very common gun. And also, though, the Fiat was Otsuka's car. Like, they wanted to draw the car he owned, which also allowed them to get a lot more specific details on it. It was a very detail-oriented show, which, like, a lot of anime, especially in television production, you don't have time for that kind of detail or to draw the perfect car. But they were like, no, if we're going to draw a Fiat, it looks like a Fiat. If he's going to drive by a Jeep, it looks like a Jeep. The show looks archaic, part one, by today's standards, but I think Miyazaki and Takahata really accomplished a lot with it.
Yeah, it is kind of homework compared to the more fun part two, and then part three is like just crazy 80s and but like some really fun drawings in that show.
But
pink jacket is so 80s, it's great.
Part one's Green Jacket, and that it again, for a show that gets a huge replacement of the major staff in the middle of it, it's a credit to Otsuka as a stabilizing force that it even stayed together as much as it did. Unfortunately, though, not a hit. Canceled at 23 episodes.
Ooh,
so
yeah.
Didn't even finish their 26 episode order, but it will be looked back on as groundbreaking and influence a generation of otaku. Also worth mentioning, in part one, it's where Miyazaki started doing some mentoring of his own, because he met a young animator named Yoshifumi Kondo, who would be an animator on many of Miyazaki's projects, though not Cagliostro. And he would work closely with Miyazaki until his tragic passing during the production of Princess Mononoke. But Yoshifumi Kondo, in his early 20s, met Miyazaki on the first Lupin series. So while not initially popular, it was canceled. Miyazaki even tells a funny story of going to the Christmas party that year and the TMS boss just like deeply bowing to everyone and just like, I'm so sorry. Miyazaki and Takahata, they'd continue to work with Otsuka at TMS for a little bit, along with Yoichi Kotabe, the amazing animator in his own right, on Panda Go Panda and its sequel, which are basically proto Totoro films.
Protoro.
But then the big change happens in 74. Miyazaki, Takahata, and Kotabe, they leave TMS while Otsuka sticks around because he's really enjoying his position there. And they work on Heidi of the Alps, the first of the World Masterpiece Theater TV series. And it's really hard to undersell how huge that was in Japan in 1974. Like, this is what made Miyazaki famous. Before he was the Ghibli guy, he would just say, oh, he's the Heidi guy. Oh, Heidi, we all watched that. Millions of Japanese people watched it.
Did it kick off World Masterpiece Theater, or was Masterpiece Theater inspired by the success of Heidi? I forget how it goes.
I believe it's the first hit they have, if not the first one they did. Yeah. It also set a whole new standard for background design, too, in this. Just a level of quality that I also think is why you see such gorgeous background paintings in Castle of Cagliostro too. They're just trying to, you know, go to the theatrical level above what they did on television with Heidi.
With another European setting.
Yes, yeah. I mean, Miyazaki himself, huge Euro fan. Like, he loves Europe so much. Hates America. Well, doesn't. Hey, I don't blame him. He shouldn't like America. But yeah, actually, a lot of the research he does for Heidi of the Alps, He just kind of transfers that over to Cagliostro. He's like, oh, I know what European mountains look like. Here's the photos we did for it. But Otsuka is working at TMS on a show called Samurai Giants, a baseball show that gets killed in the ratings by Heidi. And so he's like, ah, Miyazaki's beating me. And thanks to the huge popularity of Heidi, Miyazaki works on several more adaptations. He works on Dog of Flanders. He works on Marco, 3,000 Leagues to Mother. And then he starts working on, with Takahata, Anne of Green Gables. At the same time, Otsuka is working on some of those, but he's still keeping a foot in TMS. But in 1978, before Anne of Green Gables, Miyazaki, in the creative lead, though still working with Takahata, is doing Future Boy Conan, another amazing TV series. This one I've watched fully, and it's just great. And Otsuka assisted with a ton of brilliant animation on that show. Though Otsuka, in his documentary, is like, oh, Miyazaki's much more controlling than when he was my student. Oh boy, he's tough. This guy, he even says, like, Otsuka would do key animation, and Miyazaki would, like, throw it out and redo it himself. It's like, geez.
Sounds like a less worse John Chris Felucci.
A little bit. I mean, he's I think he's a nicer person in interpersonally. In Otsuka's book, there's a drawing of Miyazaki in a tank shouting at him. Like, that's his experience as a coworker.
And you've watched Future Boy Conan, and you said it's good. It's very slow, though.
Really? Yeah. I mean, yes, it could. In 26 episodes, it could be squished down into like 20, but it's still amazing. And you will see Miyazaki gaining his confidence as the show goes on. And I mean, especially, it's already the confidence he has of, like, I'm not adapting anything. This is my original story I'll just sell on just my name as the Heidi guy. So they work on that together. And I liken Takahata and Miyazaki, like, they're now the makers of prestige TV. Like, that's how respected they are. Like, they can kind of pick their shots of what they want to do. Meanwhile, late 70s TMS, their reruns of Lupin Part 1 doing great. It has turned far more popular than they expected it to be. So they were able to sell a new Lupin show to a television station in 1977. The only problem for TMS is that their key staff, including Otsuka, is gone, and they have to, like, rebuild and make it with, like, four different studios that are all, like, failing at it, kind of. It's the first 100 episodes of Lupin are so patchy. They're all over the place.
Yeah, they're a fun patchwork mess to watch. And it's like, it has 155 episodes. And if you subscribe to Crunchyroll, like, for a month, just up front, it's like, well, here's 200 plus Lupin episodes. Take your pick.
Just that end in 1980, and then you can watch more after that. Yeah. So they're working with outsider studios, but they're also starting their own internal studio, Telecom, which they're trying to build up, and it has little involvement, though, from Part One staff. But it's still doing so well that they're able to get Otsuka away from Future Boy Conan. Like, he's finishing up with Future Boy Conan, just as Telecom is like, this Lupin show is doing so well, we're making a movie. And so Otsuka is brought on to be the animation director on the first Lupin film, Mystery of Mamo. And that film, I actually rewatched that ahead of this to give me good perspective on what the difference between the first and second film is. Mamo is a quadruple length episode of the TV show. Like, it's crazy and funny and full of great animation, but it doesn't offer much beyond, like, yeah, it's just a big Lupin adventure. And I guess what it offers is more explicit nudity from Fujiko.
That's why you're buying that ticket.
Like, her first scene in the movie is a shower scene. Like, that's how you're introduced to her. But Otsuka directed on it, or animation directed, and in his supervisor role, he was very disappointed with the Telecom team, and thought he also worked with them on the TV show, the episodes that followed Mamo, and he's like, God, I have to redo everything on this. I am ashamed. Like, this is terrible. And so he is trying to rebuild the Telecom staff, like, one hire at a time, because he is a really good eye for animator talent. So he's starting to rebuild it, which is helpful, because Telecom, at the start of 79, sees what a big hit Mama was, they're like, well, we're making a second movie right now. And yeah, I think, you know, if you want to watch a thing that feels what traditional Lupin is, I would suggest watching Mama just to experience that in a higher quality version than you would from just watching a random episode of part one or part two. So Otsuka is first offered to direct this second Lupin film, and he starts working on a story, but by March of 79, he feels the plot is too boring. And he also just, again, he's like, I don't want to direct. It's no fun. He turns to Miyazaki. Miyazaki is 15 episodes into working under Takahata on Anne of Green Gables, but he is offered a chance to direct a film. His first film he can direct. And so he's like, fuck you, Anne, I'm out of here. This actually is the breaking point of the traditional Miyazaki and Takahata relationship.
Aww.
Like, Miyazaki had been under Takahata's shadow for so long. He was already straining with it on Conan. Here he was having to do it again on Anne of Green Gables. And he, like, in interviews I watched, he's like, I was just ready to go. I couldn't do it anymore. It was my time. Like, he couldn't take direction from Takahata any longer. Basically, from then on, while they would always work together, like, they were the two figureheads of Ghibli, Takahata would basically be searching for another Miyazaki the rest of his career. He'd be getting different animation directors to basically animate the things he wanted to see seen. And Miyazaki regarded him as a rival. And if you watched the Kingdom of Madness and Dreams documentary, he's just straight up a dick to Takahata. He's like, yeah, this guy can't finish anything. He doesn't want to. He's bad at it.
I think after one of the animators, the animator who passed away on Mononoke, you mentioned before, right?
Kondo, yeah, yeah.
Like, a lot of people did not forgive Miyazaki because of that. They felt like Miyazaki's overworking nature and his influence on his employees is what basically killed that man.
The argument could be made.
Yeah, I would say.
And I think Miyazaki regretted it too. Like, I think
that did make him rethink his lifestyle too.
Yeah, I think you watched some docs that were made after Mononoke. He has softened a little bit, at least in his, like, the hours he's demanding people do. Though I get the sense from the clips I see in there that he doesn't like having to soften. And you see in so many Miyazaki films, the value of hard work, like, hard work makes you a person. It increases your value as a person, which is definitely what a workaholic would feel. And so I think he probably is one of those types who's like, I work 17 hours a day drawing every single thing in here. Why can't you do the same?
Yeah, that's just like the most toxic work culture where people are like competing with each other instead of working together. Just like, no, I'm working harder.
Well, and it sucks that Miyazaki has produced such culturally important and beautiful art, because then it feels like an endorsement of his work style practice.
Yeah. But also Ghibli would eventually just become a failing company, you know? Yeah, so maybe it wasn't such a good idea.
I mean, this skips ahead, but the real secret of Ghibli is that Suzuki-san producer who's like, yeah, let's sell every Totoro thing we can.
Yeah, that's merchandising, exactly, as our good buddy Yogurt would say.
So Miyazaki breaks his professional relationship with Takahata, leaves Takahata to finish Anne of Green Gables while he takes on his first feature film. And he has a ton more confidence than before. And he's got Otsuka backing him up, overseeing a team of hand-picked animation talent, and they couldn't have had a better team to work with, though their timeline was less than 1 year. This is a film
that's insane.
Like, the quality of this film, it was produced, the boarding took 3 months, production was 4 to 5 months. That was it. Like,
wow.
Miyazaki hired in March, film released December.
And it's an hour and 40 minutes.
Yeah.
Back to Takahata real quick. I do want to do one of our What a Cartoon Movie months. I do want to do like Takahata month, because I feel like his movies are overlooked because they don't have the Miyazaki stamp. Even though they're Ghibli movies, they're great. Like Only Yesterday and Pompoko got really recent releases in America, like shockingly recently that those movies come out here, and they're so good, especially Only Yesterday.
I love that so much.
Yeah. Low-key autobiographical movie about Japan in the 60s. It's so cool.
Yeah, I also watched his Gouch the Cellist, which is another, it's like an hour long. It's really great too. You can just find that on YouTube too.
It's such a weird, like, you can go buy the Miyazaki collection on whatever, whenever that came out. It's just like, but there are other movies. Just stick the other four movies in there. What are you losing?
And fortunately, all the Ghibli films will be on HBO Max, so that includes the Takahata ones. I mean, yeah, Takahata, he also didn't promote himself in America in the way the PR machine got behind Miyazaki, so that's also why we don't know him. I do think he's more known in Japan.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, Miyazaki got a big PR push because, like, what we thought would be the modern-day Walt Disney, John Lasseter, was like, I'm going to vouch for my good buddy. I made Toy Story. You like that? You love Finding Nemo. What about this guy? I'm good friends with him. Did I mention that we're friends yet?
Good old me. I had to skip through a lot of Lasseter. Say, thank God Lasseter's not in the Otsuka documentary. I feel like he was clawing to get his way in there. But
I do think, like, back when we liked that guy, that was a very big, important push for a fairly xenophobic country, especially when it came to Japan. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the plot was slightly inspired by LeBlanc's Countess of Cagliostro character. And Miyazaki envisioned a story about a Lupin team maturing and growing up. It's also why Lupin in this is Green Jacket, because it's kind of a statement of Miyazaki saying, I'm bringing back my Lupin from part one and ending his story. So this is kind of like, I don't want to say Dark Knight Returns, but you know how when a master of a classic character returns to tell the final story of Spider-Man or Batman or anything? I think that was Miyazaki's approach to Lupin. He's like, this is my final word on him.
It's also a good color choice just for how this movie looks. I think red would have been too garish for these like beautiful European backdrops.
When his blood red is just, it's too violent. Like this is the green of the more peaceful Miyazaki Lupin. It fits. Like, he's a kinder, gentler Lupin, and he needs a green jacket. So the co-credited writer is screenwriter Haruya Yamazaki. Hayao basically threw his script in the trash and then just drew a storyboard he wanted. And TMS probably, because of the tight deadline, they're just like, yeah, we approve that. Just do it. And so Otsuka talked about how Miyazaki loves storyboarding because he is a comic artist at heart, not an animator. Or not a comic artist first, not an animator. And with a very tight schedule, Miyazaki also had to cut some things. He had a different fourth act in mind. And they're like, no, this is 100 minutes. You gotta change up that third act. Also, Otsuka talked about how they started animating before all the storyboards were finalized because the trains just got to start moving. And he said it was a harrowing production. Like, nobody got to leave for 4 months. You just sleep in the office pretty much. He joked of like, yeah, I think it was Miyazaki who made me stay in the office all the time. Though it's funny, in another interview I saw with him, this wasn't in the doc, but he was being asked like, that sounds pretty rough. But he's like, well, you know, today's young animators, they're a little too free. I think they need this kind of hard work and concentration we had. He said that, like, he's like, oh, modern anime. And when he's saying this, it's 2007, but he's like, modern anime is too factory feeling, you know. I think he sounds a little bit in this interview like an old timer saying like, well, in my day, we, you know, it was hard, but it made great stuff. So
it's funny because there was no Studio Ghibli bar. There was no standard. It didn't have to look this good. It could have looked like half as good and still would have been a passable Lupin movie. But
everyone would have accepted a half as good Lupin movie as a good Lupin movie. But I think a Miyazaki's feeling I get was, he's like, if I'm coming back to Lupin, I'm going all out. And also, I'm free of Takahata, so I can indulge in all this artistic stuff he would tell me not to do. Now, I do want to take a quick moment to talk about some key animators on this who were really big to it. First is Kazuhide Tomonaga. Again, an amazing animator. If you go, like, just look up an animation reel of him, he did great stuff on basically everything he worked on. He was kind of a TMS lifer. In the film, his biggest animation chunks I could find were the opening chase scene is largely Tomonaga as animator, and a bits of the clock tower battle at the end too. Like, he's so Tomonaga, huge part of that. He'd work on a lot of TMS stuff, including he animated at least parts of the iconic Batman opening.
Oh, nice.
Like, when you think of that guy punching at Batman's head and then the way Batman's head kind of snakes around it, that was Tomonaga.
Were you posting a bunch of GIFs from him? There's like a Tiny Toons one I saw of like Babs like running around all of her like siblings.
Well, that's actually the second person I'm going to mention here. That was Atsuko Tanaka. a key animator on the film, and also one of the rare women in her generation animating stuff. She was fairly new to animation at this time. I actually think of when we did Kiki's Delivery Service, how Miyazaki said he was making the film for all the young women he sees in animation career as a tribute to them. I think of Atsuko as one of those women he's talking about, but I mean, I could be wrong, but this was early in her career. She's just masterful already. Like, Tanaka was known for her ability with like character animation and most specifically eating. Battle between Lupin and Jigen in here, that's all her.
Every noodle is accounted for in that scene.
And also, another iconic shot from Cagliostro, Lupin climbing up and then, he's running really fast down the tilted rooftop, and then he has to jump. That was
nice
her
Bionic
too.
Man sound effect in that too.
And if you look at her animation reel too, if you see good food animation in a Ghibli film, it was probably Atsuko. She probably did it. And though she kind of is like, she comes on to work on a Ghibli thing, but a lot of her career in the 80s and 90s was still spent at TMS. She was a director on Cyber Six. We talked about her. She directed one of the best Cyber Six episodes. Animator on Animaniacs, Batman, Superman, Sonic Adventures. She did Adventures of Sonic animation as well.
Really? Not you're not talking about Sonic X?
No. Adventures of Sonic. There's clips in her animation reel you can find on YouTube.
Wow. Like,
and some of the best action bits. Okay, you've seen Return of the Joker, the Batman Beyond movie.
Yeah.
The opening big fight with like the levitating like forklift thing. That was her. She
awesome.
Animated on that.
Any Akira.
You know, I didn't see any Akira in there, actually. But Atsuko, yeah, she's... when I saw that she was the food person, like, food always looks perfect in Miyazaki stuff. I think Miyazaki, you know, loves to have eating scenes in it, and he counts on Atsuko to be the animator for the best food scenes in his stuff. And the soundtrack was handled by Yuji Ono, who was the main composer for Part 2, including the timeless Lupin theme song.
Oh, man. Reused. In every theme, every series they would do. My favorite one, I think, is Part 4, because it's like, you know what Cowboy Bebop stole from us? We're just going to do the Cowboy Bebop opening with Lupin characters, and it rules. It's good.
It's so good. You're right. Yeah. That might be my favorite, too. I just hearing it everywhere, the many different versions of it, like, and I mean, Ono's jazzy stylings, like, Cowboy Bebop in general just like lifted that right there. They used it. I love Yoko Kanno, so I'm not saying she stole it. But use that as a starting point of like, oh, this is how creative we can be with the music. Like, and Lupin without the jazz, like it doesn't make sense. Like, though they don't use the theme in the movie, but the guy still is using like these kind of jazzy tones for the movie.
It feels like they're really holding back, because in the TV series, that theme is played at least once. Like, whenever the big action set piece happens at the end, it's like they always play the Lupin instrumental theme.
Crazy workload, animated in 5 months after the pre-production period, but they got it out, and they opened the film December 15th, 1979 in Japan to a modest profit of a few million dollars. Was seen at the time as a disappointment for TMS, but as word of mouth spread, it quickly became one of their most famous productions.
And then American director saw it, and I was like, oh, I'll take that, and I'll take that scene. Oh, and that scene's mine, too. Oh, and that one. I want that one.
And the film was divisive even among Lupin fans, because some, you know, loved its wistfulness, and it took time, and it treated the characters as a more mature way, but others were like, no, my Lupin is like a violent murderer who laughs as he shoots at people. Like, this Lupin isn't naughty enough, and Fujiko isn't wearing tight enough dresses. Like, and yeah, I'm not saying one's better than the other either. Like, they're two different flavors of Lupin.
It's probably, I mean, I know it wasn't, I wouldn't say shocking, but it was interesting to go from this to the TV Lupin and realizing just how different the tones were.
And Miyazaki and Otsuka, though, after the production of this, they would stick around Telecom, and Takahata would join them about a year or two later. And they were pretty much kept on by TMS to just build Telecom as a studio. Like, they keep hiring on staff, improving the quality, and just training them. Like, they're... they're creators, but they're also teachers pretty much. And Miyazaki even agrees. Otsuka is 10 times the teacher he is. Like, he is a much better and nicer animation teacher. But I think, you know, I said it on Kiki One, I'll say it again. The reason TMS that we saw in 80s and 90s animation was so good is in part because they were so well trained by Miyazaki and Otsuka after they were hired back for Castle of Cagliostro. And so they would work with Telecom on more Lupin shows, including Miyazaki pretty much brings back together the Cagliostro team to animate two episodes of the show. Episodes 145, The Flight of the Albatross, and episode 155, I think it's like Sayonara Lupin, Goodbye Lupin.
Yeah, and if you want to just like get a little taste of the TV series, you can just watch those. It's really episodic. There's no continuity. Just like, here's another adventure in Lupin's life.
In episode 145, it's a giant plane battle. And in episode 155, it's basically the robot from Castle in the Sky doing stuff. But also, if you watch those before you watch the rest of part two, you will be spoiled because it is near theatrical level animation that the rest of the series, even in their best episodes, can't really match. But they're great to watch. After you've seen Cagliostro, if you want to experience the similar feel, pull up episodes 145 and 155. So Miyazaki would stick around at TMS for a little bit longer to work on that Sherlock Hound show and also try to develop Little Nemo into a movie before just giving up and going like, fuck this. I've got a comic book I'd like to adapt. Yes.
And we all know the failure of Little Nemo made all of our American TV animation much better for about like 7 or 8 years.
Yep. Though Otsuka did stick around TMS for a good while as a supervisor of many productions and just like a guy who would say, oh, no, draw Bugs Bunny this way or whatever. And he's stuck around until I think his late 60s when he basically retired. He'll still also pop in on a Ghibli project from here and there, but I watched that late 2000s interview with him where he's just like, I'm too old. I can't do this. Also, you get no creative freedom on animation production anymore in Japan, unless you're Miyazaki. I don't want to do it.
Miyazaki not retired despite threatening to for the past 20 years. And yeah. I guess currently working on a film?
I believe a feature is due out this year or the next from him. Yeah. Wow. And I believe it's CGI also. Like, yeah. The Wind Rises was supposed to be his finale, but he's still at it. Otsuka probably even helping him with it. And yes, sadly, Takahata did pass away last year or two. So.